This is Authors in Focus.
Hi, I'm Michael Levin. I'm a writer, publisher, and author publicist. Looking for a fun satirical read? Check out The Cider and Ale Chronicles by myself and JMD Reed, out now on Amazon. And look forward to Max and the Captain, which drops this February. Today, I'm joined by Drew Kentz, author of the A Perfect Order series. Welcome back to the Authors in Focus podcast. Today we're here with Drew Kentz, author of the A Perfect Order series, beginning with Chrysalis, book one in the series. How's everything going with you today, Drew?
Oh, hey, man, you know, it's another day above ground. Good day as always.
Good to hear. Yeah, it's bitter cold where I'm from right now, so dealing with Canadian winter coming in pretty hardcore.
Yeah, I've never experienced that. I've only heard horror stories about it.
Oh, it's everything that you've heard and more. So, you know, taking it one day at a time. But, you know, it is what it is. You pay the price when you live in Canada. So that's where we're at. So I like to always start these interviews with a couple of fun questions before we get into the heavy ones. So question number one, if you could have a drink or, you know, any type of drink, even a coffee, with any author living or dead, who would it be and why?
Oh, man, gonna lead with an easy one, huh? It'd probably be Granddaddy Tolkien, probably.
Awesome, cool.
Yeah, I've always considered him a savant, and, you know, his world building is second to none.
Yeah, well, I mean, he created a whole language, and even so many, and such a vast history, and even so many years later when, the realm of possibility in fantasy literature has obviously expanded, and you know, he kind of tested the ground, I guess, and you know, the founder and the originator of everything that was possible. You can still go back and read Lord of the Rings and discover something new about it every single time.
Yeah, you know, it's not exactly what you'd call light reading, you know, especially when you get to the Silmarillion, but you know, before him, take the trope of the immortal elf, you know, that we have these days, you know, that usually there's a bow involved and they're swordsmen and that sort of thing. And before him, they were just mischievous fairies, you know, in Norse mythology. So, yeah, he took just pretty much everything that we know today and everything that we take for granted. It was all due to him.
Yeah, no, definitely. I try to go back and read The Lord of the Rings at least once every couple of years. I haven't really read The Silmarillion yet, although I've heard, you know, people either love it and say it's absolutely mandatory or they don't. It's kind of divided.
Oh, yeah. It's like encyclopedic and all the things that are going on in it. And, you know, it's going back throughout the ages over thousands of years, discussing the full history down to individual battles of what's going on in Lord of the Rings. So, but it's not an easy read by any chance. It's more like you're reading some sort of mythical text, you know, some poem
right.
of knowledge.
Yeah. I'm really curious, how much of that is going to be touched on in the new, TV series, because I think it's very strange. It's strange that, at least as of right now, they're billing the series as The Lord of the Rings, yet it's not going to have any of the characters that everybody associates with The Lord of the Rings in it, and it's actually taking place in the past. I wonder if that's just a marketing thing, because people will tune in, like if they had called it something else, and then underneath in small print said, from the world of Lord of the Rings, or from the world of J.R.R. Tolkien, they would have, you know, just not had the same level of success that they're inevitably going to get out of this series calling it Lord of the Rings.
Well, is that what the official title of it is? It's just going to be The Lord of the Rings by Amazon?
Everything I've read about it, and I've read quite a bit, like so far, it's referred to as The Lord of the Rings. It's a Lord of the Rings, you know, series. So I don't know. And I've had discussions about this on. Yeah, it's strange. I mean, it's going to people in the world of this stuff, people that are always on social media, that are always reading, that are tapped into what it's all about. You know, I guess the hardcores in our world that we swim in, you know, we'll do that research and we'll figure it out and stuff like that. But the average, you know, the lay person that would have maybe gone to see Peter Jackson's movies and, you know, maybe didn't even read the books, are going to be pretty confused and weirded out when they don't see Frodo and Aragorn. And,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, just the title alone would make me think it has something to do with, you know, with the One Ring, but the One Ring's been around for so long. I mean, that could be all kinds of different things, but if you go by just the title alone, Lord of the Rings, well, there you're probably looking at the books, but from what I've read, it's supposed to be, you know, be back 2,000-3,000 years before the events of
yeah.
Peter Jackson's movie. So,
yep. Yeah. Yeah.
So that anyway. See, to me, that's exciting because there's all kinds of, you know, different directions you could go with that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's definitely cool. I mean, it's cool to, it's always, and look, I've had conversations about Wheel of Time as well with people.
Oh, yeah.
I run another podcast and we actually interviewed, we got into a big conversation with Steven Erickson about this, James Reed and my co-host James Jenkins and I about Wheel of Time, because a lot of people are purists, mm-hmm. and they don't want to watch Wheel of Time because, you know, it's gonna, they say it's, they've heard that it messes with the source material too much.
Yeah, but I think it's wonderful. I've read the entire saga and, I mean that, yeah, they're fast forwarding here and there, but there's so much content. I mean, well, you know, look, talking about the Lord of the Rings, talking about massive amount of content to try to get onto film. And,
right.
Overall, though, I've been kind of pleased with it. There's some, they're going in a different direction, but not too much to where it's unrecognizable. But
right.
You know, they're kind of hitting the fast forward button here and there. And to me, going into from one medium to the other, from books to film, you know, you got to do that sometimes.
Right.
And
we got into, and that's what Steven's like big argument was, everybody that loves fantasy books and everybody that, enjoys fantasy movies, should be happy that they're doing this because it means that there will be more fantasy, TV shows and, this will build and, you know, more of our favorite series will get this type of adaptation. And
yeah,
I'd
like that adaptation for my books. It's one day.
Right. I mean, everybody, that's the dream, right? The
right.
dream is that, you know, what is kind of, a little bit niche and a little bit, you know, subculture will become at least mainstream enough that it will draw more people into the books and more people in to, other opportunities and other books and other authors. So yeah, I mean, I kind of agree. Like I don't get hung up on stuff like that. I try it out. If I like it, cool. If I don't, move on. But I'm glad that they're trying, something new with Lord of the Rings, because I think it's just another opportunity to take a mainstream property and, use it to open the door for potentially, smaller properties to get a shot.
Yeah, they could definitely make, I mean, Lord of the Rings alone, they could make as many seasons as they had the money to make. If there
yeah.
was a
oh,
demand
yeah.
for it, there's just
people
so
are.
Much source material there. And
people.
And with the Wheel of Time for that, you know, Jordan, he wrote, it's a full saga, you know, it's 15 books and each one's about, what, 700-800 pages or so. So it's a, yeah, there's all kinds of stuff there they can draw on. So I appreciate that challenge. So I went into it with an open mind with, Wheel of Time. And, the first episode, the first half, I was kind of, you know, there was that shock of how I visualized a character versus how they're, you know, who they casted and they're just the way they talk and everything. But by the end of the first episode, I was on board. It was pretty awesome. So that's my take.
Yeah, I agree.
Take.
I had no issues. So the second question, which I'm actually going to steal from my co-host of Book and a Pint. Hope he's okay with that. People talk about guilty pleasures and, you know, things that they like that other people would be surprised about and look at a person and say, wow, weird. I wouldn't necessarily take you for that. I don't really think there's, you know, necessarily, you know, anything that, people should be guilty about, but if there was something that you enjoyed that people would be like, really? Like, I wouldn't necessarily take Drew for being into that, what would it be?
Oh, man. Well, you could probably go down my Spotify playlist and find all kinds of artists that you'd be like, oh, Drew listens to them. Okay.
Yeah, all me right. too.
I don't really have one that's like some big guy. I mean, I wasn't expecting a question like that. I'm sorry. I can't curse on here, can I?
I think you can. I mean, it's not off limits.
Oh, okay. Man, I was literally I'm out here in the front of my property and I'm like looking around for help. Like, what would be something? I'll have to go with something like, I'm a huge animal lover. I mean, I guess that would be something you can't just look at somebody and guess, I suppose. Like, I've got a big heart when it comes to animals.
My dog is sleeping at my feet right now while I'm talking to you. So
right.
That's
mine's at the fence line going, Dad, why are you in the car right now?
Spotify is a good thing. Like for me, I've always been like, I come from years in the music industry and I've also come from years of songwriting and production, working in studios and, you know, I've worked on production of other artists' work as well. And I've always, been a champion of Taylor Swift's, songwriting. And a lot of people would look at me and say, really? And my answer is like, yeah, she's an amazing pop songwriter that really knows her market and really knows her audience. And she taps into a connection. And in my opinion, there's absolutely no, possible question why she is as enormous as she is.
Well, I guess, when it comes to something like that, I mean, I've honestly only heard a handful of her songs. I'm not trying to say that to be edgy or something. It's just not my type. However, that being said, there is definitely a craft to being able to write consistently over a period of a long time of writing music that appeals to the masses on such a grand scale.
Right.
When it comes to that, I would say she's probably some of the best that's ever existed from her level of fame. I would probably say like Halsey, like she's one of those pop starlets I'm really into. And somebody was giving me some grief over Bring Me the Horizon the other day because that was on my Spotify 2021 wrap up, and they're like, well, which Bring Me the Horizon? And I'm like, I don't know. I just started listening to them like 6 months ago. So there you go. There's some guilty pleasures, though. The reason why I don't say video games is because everyone who knows me knows I'm a huge gamer. So,
well, I mean, yeah. I think a lot of our community, especially, the fantasy writing community, I'm actually an anomaly in that I never really was a gamer. I own a Switch and I'll play like Super Mario Odyssey with my kids and stuff like that. But, that's kind of the extent of it. But yeah, I mean, in this like tabletop gaming RPGs and stuff, it's almost like I'm the anomaly and I get invited like into so many campaigns, D&D campaigns and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And my answer to everybody is like, there's a reason why there's one kid that's picked last for volleyball in gym. And trust me, you don't want me in your campaign. Like I'm going to be I would be that guy. So.
I've been playing since I was quite literally 11 years old and I'm 38 now. I took a break in there for a while. Cause you get burned out eventually. But now it's like, it seems like just culturally, like society is like completely thrown open the doors to accepting, you know, gaming of all types. It's pretty much part of, the zeitgeist now.
Totally.
And I could teach you. I'm a good teacher. I've teached lots of noobs.
Well, I'm down. Like, yeah, like I agree. Like for me, it was like when I was in school, I was in the band scene, like the rock music scene. That was my scene. And there were guys there was like the tabletop gaming scene and stuff. And our scenes didn't connect. Whereas now I feel like a lot of there would be a lot of connection and like the culture has really changed. I'm a little bit older than you, so I don't know, not much, but the whole culture, I want to call it geek culture to an extent, has become very mainstream and has become very accepted.
Well, you know, it's all the nerds. We're the ones who built all this stuff.
Right. No, it's true. Yeah.
No, yeah, man, I understand that. I was kind of an anomaly when you talk about high school, like the high school kids didn't know where to file me because I was kind of, everybody wants you to be nicely labeled and, you know, put filed away in a cabinet somewhere. But I was kind of into everything, man. I was into sports, music, gaming, you know, writing, of course, that's always been a first love. So, but no, I understand what you're saying though. Like I get it. Yeah. I'd pick you first though, if that makes you feel better, Michael.
I appreciate that. So let's talk about your own writing and get into specifically Chrysalis. So when did you get that writing bug specifically? You mentioned just now that you've always been into writing, so it went back a while. But at what point did you kind of say, okay, well, I really dig writing. I'm going to do something pretty crazy, and I'm going to write a novel? Because that's one of those things. Yeah. Writing a novel is kind of one of those things that a lot of people put on their bucket lists of great things they want to do with their lives. I want to write a novel. So where was that for you?
Oh, well, you're right in that it goes back a long, long time. I loved just art in general first, and then the writing came I was a kid, and I would write short stories, and even back in the AOL days, I would write short stories, and they become chain letters and eventually get back to me. And then with the D&D thing, that was a tool I used to help exercise, like, improvisation and writing with knowing that multiple different outcomes are possible, you know. And right. Then life went on, and I'm a really curious guy, and I went down lots of different roads, like career paths and jobs and stuff, and never found that one that was my calling, you know, if you want to say it that way, my passion. And I got into my 30s, and somebody just asked me flat out, they're like, why aren't you writing? You've always been a good writer. And I didn't have an answer for them. So I just kind of decided I'm going to go ahead and do this. And it was whenever I watch anything, movies, shows, when I'm reading, you know, all the different types of books I've read, playing games, I'm like absorbing ideas like a sponge, you know, like what worked here? What didn't? What would I have done differently? And a Perfect Order, the series, has given me a chance to express that. And, you know, as you know, the main thing I love about it is when you're in that creative zone, that loop of your, like, I always have to have music going in my headphones. I can't write without it. Some people are different, I know. But with me, like, when I'm in my zone and I'm creating and I'm seeing what I'm doing, you know, I'm getting that kind of like that feedback loop of creation and seeing it and then sharing it, of course, and, you know, getting feedback. Like, I write to be read. Like, I write with the express intent of an audience is going to read this. And, you know, there's some people who write for in their spare time, like as a hobby, and do poetry and stuff. And I've always just wrote with the intent that I want people to see this. I want to entertain, and I take that very seriously. And serious fun. It's time's the only currency we have. So if people are going to give me their money and their time to entertain them, I take it pretty seriously. I think they're going to have a good time with it.
Yeah, that's actually, that first of all, a couple. I was taking in a few of the different things you said. One of them is music being first passion of mine, also very important.
Yeah.
I generally write all my books to music. I'll actually each one of you can actually see, because I have them all and I've posted a lot of them, playlists that are the music that I was listening to when I was writing a certain book.
I've got to tell you, I got to interject here. Both of the books and all of them that will be coming, because I've got this thing outlined about 7 at least. Just, you know, hey, if people are still reading it, then we'll keep going. But yeah, I have a playlist at the beginning of both books that is the ambient music background noise that the characters are actually hearing. So what you can actually, I've got a Spotify playlist already made for readers, and they can listen to the songs the characters are listening to and just kind of add that layer of immersion to it.
Yeah, that's awesome. I do it a little bit differently. Like, I tend to, well, with A Portrait of Dirk, which was a kind of a personal project that was sort of a half stream of consciousness, personal memoir mixed with a fictional story, and it all kind of ties together. I had been listening to pretty much exclusively Dream Theater. While that was going on. So I actually, and there was, and so I made a Dream Theater playlist, and I said, this is what I was listening to. When I've been working on Here Comes Steve, I was listening to mainly a band called Little Feet. So I made a playlist.
Little what? What was that?
Little Feet.
There. Okay.
Feet. Yeah, with an EAT like the Beatles.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome band. 70s band. I actually know a lot of the members personally, so there's a little bit of a sentimental thing there. But with other books like Max and the Captain, the trilogy, I actually thought of it in terms of film. So it's not like I've got this massive grand ambition to try and turn Max and the Captain into a movie or into a TV series. But I imagined as I was writing it and as we were going through sections, what would be my dream songs for each individual part of this?
Yeah.
And I actually put a playlist together with detailed, this is what you should be listening to during this fight scene. This is what you should do. And a lot of people think it's crazy, but it's just the way my mind works.
Well, why do people think that's crazy? Because that's exactly, I see things very cinematically when I'm writing.
Right.
Me too. Like it's all like through the lens of, you know, my mind's eye, like the, you know, a camera lens. And music is so intrinsic. I mean, the main character, Jennifer, she's a professional musician anyway. So there's that. But just to the experience of it, like, music has always been integral to A Perfect Order, creating it and then experiencing it as well. Yeah, for sure.
Right. Another thing that struck a chord with me is, you know, I hear so many, I've interviewed, like, I was an interviewer for a number of blogs before I started, you know, working directly with authors. So I've been interviewing, and I've interviewed a ton of authors over the last 4 or 5 years. And one of the things that I hear regularly is I write for myself. I don't think about an audience. I don't care about an audience. I would be writing this anyway. If people like it, then that's cool. And I get that.
Yeah.
I think it's important. I think it's important to have, if you don't have buy-in with what you're doing and you don't enjoy what you're doing and you don't enjoy what you're writing and you're solely thinking about marketability when you're writing, which is a process kind of, you know, called write to market, where,
mm-hmm.
You know, you get into ghostwriters that will write from a series, branded series, that kind of thing, then it might be difficult to expect that type of buy-in from your audience. But I definitely do think about entertaining, like, and wanting people to, and that's the reason why I teach,
yeah,
and why everything I write and everything I put out, I want people to enjoy, experience, and want to talk to me about it. Because there's nothing I love more than when somebody just wants to talk about something that I've written, if it's moved them, if it's made them feel something.
Yes. Oh, man, I'm like, I will stop whatever I'm doing. You know? If, like, somebody messages me and wants to talk about, like, characters or powers or what does this mean? And,
yeah,
of course, you got people, like, digging for, what, you know, spoilers and stuff. But, oh, yeah, man, I absolutely love it.
Yeah. And, you know, we come from a social media world where you can drop a picture of, like, a cat falling off a couch and it'll get, like, 300 interactions in 20 minutes. And then, you know, as an indie musician, I can drop a song and say, this was my life this year in this song. Please check it out and let me know what you think. Crickets.
I know. Oh, man. I know. That's just something that drives me absolutely bonkers about social media in general, about, you know, what is getting everyone's attention. And, yeah, you're exactly right. It can be, you know, the internet's a dark carnival and there's all kinds of stuff on there. But it is unfortunate, you know, when, like, what you're talking about with, you have something that you've bled into, right? You know, to create this thing, whatever it is, whether it's, you know, are you an artist, a painter, you know, a writer, you know, with your debut book, you know, a musician just trying to get some plays out there, get some streams, and then it can be very frustrating. And hopefully, you know, what with me, it kind of depends on who you're interacting with as well. You know, you got to like find your readers out there. You have to find your audience, because these days there's somebody into everything. You know, how many humans are we up to now? 7.5 billion or something out there. So
right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I, with my background with knowing musicians and being around them and stuff, it's always been fascinating to me to analyze, like, what is it about these people who I know very well and are very talented and, you know, doing all the hard work and the stuff that people don't see, but, you know, people are barely showing up to these shows and stuff, you know? So it's always been kind of a fascination with me to looking at why the internet is the way it is, because I've been on this thing since the whole damn thing began, you know? So, I know that just on that topic, like when it comes to TikTok and stuff, that I've slowly making forays into that platform, because there's just, it's, you can't ignore like how many people are on that thing, you know?
No, I know authors, I have author friends that have, done very well with it as a marketing tool. Like literally, to the point where they're, going viral every time they post about books. And one thing that I am told, cause it's something that I've tried. Like I had my daughter, actually my 9-year-old daughter, direct me in one video on TikTok for, my series when I had my paperbacks. And I'll tell you, I posted this video, and by the time I was done, I was exhausted.
Yeah.
It's a time consuming thing. Like, one of my friends that does this tells me she posts like 3 to 4 TikTok videos a day, every single day. And that's the reason why the algorithm is taking to her. And you've got to have, you know, the commitment to be able to do that, or else, you know, you miss a day, you miss a couple of days, you fizzle out and they're on to something else.
Yeah. You get lost in the churn. Yeah, right. Man. It's crazy. The thing about it though is compared, what I have found is, you know, compared to like Facebook and Instagram and Twitter is that TikTok has more just random people like that you would never usually have any interactions with on those other platforms, who are kind of like window shopping. It's, you know, I mean, they're just, you know, scrolling for new content, and then boom, there's yours. It's something that, you know, I just kind of have been resigned to at this point. Like, I know I got to start doing that more. Like, I've got to like start a presence on that platform. It's just, man, it's a lot, you know, juggling all the social media stuff, you know?
Yeah, no, 100%. Shifting gears a little bit, just because Authors in Focus, we do have quite a lot of people that listen to the show, and it's kind of the show that's geared towards introducing authors to a community that may have never experienced or discovered them before. So I'm going to let you talk for a few minutes. Tell us about A Perfect Order, what it's all about, why people should be reading it. Just give our community the gist of this series and what's going to make it stand out for them.
A Perfect Order is about a young woman named Jennifer Appleblossom. She's 27 and she's a hardcore opiate addict, or what would be called an old fashioned drug addict back in the day. And she's also a up and coming budding musician. And she also has a power that we call Mansings in my universe, and hers is pyromancy. She can control fire. And I'm not spoiling anything, this all happens real fast at the very beginning. She has a friend, her best friend, Dr. Tuppence Buckingham, and she introduces Jennifer to this world of these people called the Enlightened. And they all have powers of some kind, and they're organized in these ancient tribal systems called orders. of like-minded individuals and people who have the same kind of philosophies and stuff. They each order has like a worldview. And Jennifer gets kind of dragged kicking and screaming into this world of secret societies, and they all have their old rivalries and stuff. They've some of these orders have been around for a few thousand years, and they do, you know, from time to time have fought with one another, but mainly it's, they're just kind of jockeying for position, because this world is full of spiritual and monstrous danger. And that's generally what the Enlightened do, is they go after things like spirits, demons, wendigos, you know, all this kind of, that sort of thing, whatever danger might present itself, and they take it out. And Jennifer, coming from her world, which is our world, perfect order is set in the near future, which just having a few years there gives me some liberties with technology if I want to introduce something that's, you know, something we don't currently have right now.
Right.
And it's mainly told from Jennifer's point of view. This is in little old Arkansas, United States, small towns, and big things happen. Want to throw me another question to lead me a little bit?
Something that I found, you know, interesting and that I wanted to ask you about was the whole idea that your people a lot of times will comment on, I guess, the accuracy of male writers writing female protagonists and female writers writing male protagonists. My question is, and I've read bits of the book, and I think that you've done a great job with it. What is it that geared you and drove you to want to write from a female perspective? And I'll go a step further and say, how much of your writing is influenced by people in your own life and yourself? Like, where, because I know for me, every single male protagonist is me, pretty much. And almost every female protagonist that's worth actually talking about in my series is some type of avatar of my wife. And I bring in lots of other character traits from other people, other family members, other friends, that kind of thing. So, is this something that you know, you employ in your writing as well? And where do you find those examples?
Well, the early reports from Chrysalis being out is that women absolutely love Jennifer, because speaking of the Wheel of Time earlier, right? One thing about Jordan is he's got powerful female characters. They don't exist from the neck down. Like Tolkien was kind of that way too. And, and nowadays though, we've got, as you were saying, we've got some male writers out there that are a little bit too focused on the body of the opposite sex.
Right.
I write my characters just like they're normal people. And that's one thing with the Enlightened, is that they do have these, some of them, you know, they have different power levels and stuff. Some of them are capable of these spectacular supernatural displays of might. But when they're done with that, they're just people. Like, and some of them have just normal, like, well, quote unquote, normal jobs and stuff. Like, one of my mains, Tuppence, is a doctor. She's an ER physician. And so I have led quite a colorful life. And I was raised predominantly by strong Southern women. And, you know, there's a lot of that in Jennifer, that she bucks at authority and traditional establishments. She hates stuff like bigotry and people who are xenophobic and things like that. And, she just is. She's got a lot of charisma. She makes mistakes. She's deeply flawed on some levels. Like, she's a fully realized, you know, 360 degree human being. And like when it comes to other characters, because out of six out of the main cast, four are women. When it comes, like you were saying, you know, some of your characters are an avatar of your wife. I tend to kind of pull like things from a certain personality that I like, and then I'll mold the character around that. I do have a handful that are like, for instance, I've got a coven of witches in the first book, and each of those people is directly a family member. So basically like them in their best light, you know. We tend to know all kinds of stuff about our family, but the characters, though, it's like these particular people, you know, like at 100%, you know. And I've just known a lot of strong women in my life, a lot of friends. My wife is the matriarch of my family. And from what I had heard, because I spent some time in the game development industry as well, when it comes to the representation front, I wasn't trying to hit, like, check any of those boxes. I was just, Jennifer is my alter ego. And I've, for whatever reason, when I was first creating her, I just knew it had to be a her. It couldn't be a guy. When I write men, it's kind of boring to me, I guess, because I've been looking at things from a man's perspective my whole life, you know?
Right.
So, when it comes to Jennifer and Tup and Amber and the rest of them, I just really do my best on them just having normal, regular human reactions to things. And I think Charlene Harris with True Blood was pretty good about that as well. And then also including humor in all things. Like, the human condition, we can go through some terrible things and find the good in it, or find something funny to laugh about. The first two original genres were comedy and tragedy. You know,
right.
So, does that answer the question well enough?
Oh yeah, no, completely. I was talking to another author, Adam Gaffin, and I asked him a similar question because he writes he's written a full series. The main characters are female and they're lesbian marriage, and he's actually won some awards for his series. And I went into that with him, and we got into the whole concept of, he gave a very similar answer to you, that he just writes people. And he writes people, and they kind of come to him, and it came to him that this was the only thing that he could write, and this was the only way it was going to be.
Cause I've been sitting here thinking a little bit while you were going. And one other thing that was kind of considered, was, I know plenty of, nerds and geeks, right? Mm-hmm. People from the nerd culture and everything. And when it comes to books, there's not a ton of women out there from the fantasy sci-fi genre that are really leading the charge, you know? And that was something I did think about. There was one character in particular. I was originally a man at first, and I went ahead and went, did a gender swap there, whatever you want to call it. And it just works better. The story I'm telling, the chemistry, I mean, as an author, like, sometimes you have these grand designs for the characters, you start writing them, and they do something else entirely, you know? So that was a little bit of it too, that the chemistry between the main cast is very good. And I think that's, that had something to do with it, was them all being women, and their personalities just talked to me better. So there you go. Right.
Yeah. And I mean, I've heard, I've heard a lot of people talk about, representation in fantasy, representation in literature and in science fiction. Straight white dudes have had so many heroes past. They've had,
yeah,
series of heroes that they can turn to. And I do think it's important that, people should be able to find a representation and a hero that speaks more directly to them. And I think a lot of people talk about that, and have been doing that. And if you look, especially in indie fantasy, And in indie sci-fi, there's so much of that. And
yes,
it's great because, you know, when
nowadays,
when we were growing up, it was like, unless you were like a straight white dude, then it was very hard to find that representation.
Most definitely. Yeah. And I saw that because Reader's Favorite, I was in their competition thing, and the urban fantasy genre, there was a few, the authors that got the podium ahead of me. We're all minorities and different genders represented. So there's definitely a push for that. That's becoming it's more widely accepted. And I think, you know, the readers they're reflecting that, you know, they're by what they buy and what they're interested in. And yeah. I think we're past time now to see. Because it's you're exactly right. It's been straight white dudes forever. It's like, it's time for us to stand aside and let some other people have the spotlight for a while. Because there's so many cool stories to be told, you know? And I think that's kind of why the genre of fantasy itself had got a little kind of worn out to me for a while, because I was tired of reading the same stories, you know, that been there, done that kind of thing. So I welcome it. I say, bring it on. Yeah.
I was asked a question in a podcast where I was on the opposing end and being interviewed about my own writing. And somebody said, what would be something that would, or a project you could work on that would really challenge you? Something that would kind of be out of your comfort zone. And that's what led to A Portrait of Dirk, which is the first book that James and I have written that is not inherently humorous. I mean, there's a little humor in it because, like you said, life, you know, as multidimensional as it can be, you can find humor in it. But it's not a funny book. It's definitely, different than the other books and than the stuff that comes before it. When I thought about it afterwards, I realized that what would really challenge me, would be to try and write from, write with a female protagonist that isn't, I've written strong female characters, but they've always been kind of more supplementary characters than the protagonist. I've always found kind of like, a comfort in my male perspective. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I guess it's just from my upbringing and my social circles and stuff. There's always been a very, very strong, like wide ranging female presence.
Right.
So it's kind of given me a little bit of insight to the other side of the coin, I guess you could say. When I'm writing men, it's more of a challenge to me to write women. Yeah. I haven't actually put a whole lot of thought to that. I wonder why that is, huh?
Well, no, it's just. It's something that I've actually been saying, like, I would like to challenge myself and try to take myself out of that comfort that I've always found. That's for another time. But, I wanted to ask you a little bit about, the publishing side of things because, you're not self-published. You're on a small press. What has been the best experience, when it comes to the publishing side? Of having your work out, and what have you found to be stumbling blocks or kind of obstacles that you've had to try to overcome while you've been sort of enduring this process?
The first thing that just popped to mind was having a team behind you. Chrysalis was my debut, and I have, you know, been in other industries where I wouldn't have felt so alone, you know, like you're part of the studio, a team, you know, whatever. But with the author thing, I mean, it kind of invites isolation a little bit, you know. But when it comes to a publisher, the first thing that jumped to my mind when you asked that was having people behind you that have been there and done that, and you know, to those questions you have at 2 o'clock in the morning or something, you know, that like there's somebody that you can reach out to and get a definite answer.
And I
that way I, it's important for me that when the product's done, you know, everybody wants their stuff to look professional and, you know, shelf ready, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And having a team of people behind me that knew the ins and outs and knew the ropes, you know, that was very reassuring. And, that I didn't have to take all that time to learn, like, oh, how to format a book properly to where it's ready to be printed, you know, and things like that. Like that's what I love about being signed and represented. And then the challenges with that, well, with being with a smaller independent publisher, well, it's money. I mean, to be flat out, like when it comes to the big five, you know, they have endless coffers, you know, and if your book's selling and they'll like you, if they like you, well, they'll throw more money behind you. Independent publishers, your strength is in the mobility of ideas. Like if something's not working right, you can change it like overnight. You know, right. It's like, hey, this is working real well. Well, we're going to double down on this and carry on. But, you know, if there was something tried in a business practice and it, you know, wasn't going too well, and you don't have to have some huge meeting and you know, like with a giant publisher and, you know, get marketing on board and, you know, your middle management and all that kind of stuff. It's like, nope, that didn't work. Okay, we're doing this now. And right. And then the accessibility of my publisher, I can talk to anyone that I need there. Everyone's just a message away. So those would be my first picks for advantages and disadvantages, pros and cons. Yeah.
Right. And I mean, a lot of people will, you know, that especially people that aren't in the know of what else is out there will, you know, kind of assume that, you know, the old school traditional publishing is, you know, still the first and foremost way. But there are many disadvantages, one being the waiting time and the process and the red tape that you have to go through. You know, another being.
Are you talking about like with a big traditional?
I'm talking
publisher?
About with like a big five publisher, like the coveted big five. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You've got that waiting time. You've got that red tape. You've got
an
advance that's actually somewhat pressure cooking because you have to be able to make that money back. And if you can't do that, you know, you'll be relegated to, you know, one of those books that gets maybe one copy in a bookstore that sits there for years until they ship it back. You know, these authors are not the authors that are burning up the charts. In fact, the indies that have the know-how and kind of learn the process and can figure out the science and the mathematics behind selling books and also understand the publicity side of things so that they can create a more of a genuine fan base based on their art. Those are the people that are kind of killing it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I've seen that with my own eyes, you know,
right.
And it's real telling, and you know, it kind of makes you think. I mean, I've known people who have gotten real frustrated, and they're like, "Well, I'm just gonna self-publish," you know, and well, there as you know, Michael, there's tons that goes into writing a book. And it's not just the content, you know, you got your editing, formatting, research while you're doing it. And of course, marketing is such a big deal, but that with these smaller presses, you know, they tend to have more of a better know-how of navigating these waters because they're down here in the trenches. You know, they're not up in some office somewhere like in New York or wherever. You know, it's like, no, they're down here seeing these reports and stuff every day live. So, there's a lot to go into this with a traditional publisher. I just prefer having that team behind me. You know, when it comes to the big five, I think there's a whole lot of bad information out there. From what I've been able to garner, you know, what you're really looking at is just the money involved. Like you already brought up the advances, but that can be a double-edged sword.
Totally.
Yeah. And then also, you know, the money for publicity. Well, you know, you get that big, they'll throw a bunch of money at you for like the first 2 weeks. And if it's not sticking, well, you know, they'll start thinking about your next project. It's like, okay, well, I didn't do well. What else you got? You know,
yep.
And for an author, that can be like, oh my God, I've got to write you another book in 6 months, you know, whatever. So it varies from case to case.
And then you've got the whole model of prolificacy of writing. I mean, for certain authors that, you know, write quality material and want to put out more than like one book a year, it's not a model that works for them because, you know what I mean? They'll only put out one book a year, sometimes like one book every 2 years. So, you know,
God, that's such a long time between release. I mean, when we're used to like, you know, let's look at a George R. R. Martin. How many years are we been waiting on Winds of Winter?
Well,
you know,
there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of politics there. And I mean, I would suspect that, there are people that probably understand the politics, more than I do when it comes to HBO and when it comes to, you know, who knows if that's ever going to happen? Like a part of me doesn't quite believe that he just hasn't been able to finish the book in like, what has it been, like 12 years? 2005.
Oh,
I think that, it came out in 2005. So we're looking at like, you know, like 17 years. Like it just seems, fishy to me, but I don't know. What? That's something that, you know, it's in the world that we live in where I see authors put out like 12 to 20 books a year. That world wouldn't work.
That is nuts to me. That's crazy to me. Like, cause I wrote, honestly, I had left myself 6 months to do Almagest, the second book, Perfect Order.
Mm-hmm.
And life happened. That got cut in half. And, I got it done in 3 months. And I felt like I was really burning the candle at both ends, you know,
right.
Like, because I've got a family of my own and all the responsibilities and stuff that we all have, you know, with a full life. And so I had got as much time to write jammed in there as I possibly could. And, when I hear about these people who are doing like double digits in a year, I just don't see how it's possible. That's just nuts to me.
Yeah. No, I mean, like, this comes down to what I tell everybody because, you know, I work with authors and a lot of people ask questions about that. And my answer is basically, you know, you've got to do you. Nobody can hold themselves up to standards that are astronomically impossible to them and possibly be able to have the emotional sustenance to be able to continue working in a creative field. You have to do what works for you and, you know, sometimes you can see things like that and be like, you know, that's really cool. Like, and they're good books too. They're not garbage books. They're amazing books and there's 12 of them. I want to try and you know, work on increasing my, word count to see if I can get into a more prolific schedule so I can get box sets out so that I can do all this stuff. But it's not so sometimes it can, if you use it as a positive to kind of, train your motivation to do things that you feel you can do on your own, then it's cool. But if you hold it to a standard where you judge yourself against those type of things, it's never going to work. So I always tell everybody,
very true.
Do what you can.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that was it. That was what I was going to say.
Well, I do, when I'm in full writing mode, I'm 2,000 words a day, 6 days a week. Now, sometimes 2,000 turns into 5. Yes, you know, some at one day it turned into 8. And for me, when I'm pulling down 7-8 plus K a day, that's a heavy work day.
Yep.
You know, but that's my groove, you know, like 2,000 words a day. And I feel good when I hit it. Like if it's been a tough day, like I feel like, all right, we hit 2, we're okay. But then sometimes you get your rhythm going and those 2 turns into 3 and 4 and 5, you know, I don't feel pressured to like meet some, cause to me, I got the 2 books out in a year and I was like, I'm doing real well.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
Like they're, look, they're both 85,000-90,000 word novels. So I was,
see, and that to me, that to me is on a level that I'm trying to, aspire to. Like I write with a co-writer and, my role is predominantly complete outlines, you know, all the editing, and I'll go in and I'll fix things and I'll add things to blend and I'll write like the first few chapters and I'll write the last few chapters and know where everything's going to go. And James does the bulk of the middle writing of stuff based on my outlines. That's kind of how we do it. But for one book, I said, okay, this is a story that's really personal to me, Max and the Captain One. I said, I want to write this book myself, and this will be the one book that is, because it was based on a story that I told my kids before bed, and I thought it would be strange to have a co-writer in that. Anyway, I was writing, and I felt like torrents of words were coming out of me. I was like, wow, I'm actually doing this. I'm actually really getting serious words on the page. And I'm like, you know, I think I've written a lot. And I put it in all my words that I had written into a word counter, 16,000 words.
That's a pretty hefty chunk, though.
And then yeah. I was like, and then I was at that point where I had another scene, and I was like, you know what? Our stuff is meta-textual, kind of Deadpool-ish, where we break the fourth wall a lot. So okay. I'm gonna bring James in to finish this book in story. And that's what I did. And I called him up and I said, look, dude, I need you to help me out with this because 16,000 words, I thought I had written 60. And so I'm aspiring to what you're trying to do, which is, you know, being able to actually write a full, all our books are short as it is. Like, you know, James writes like books that are 350,000 words, and he puts out 12 books a year of books that are like 90 to 120. I'm at the point where if I could write.
Is he human? Is he not some machine?
I think he's human. I think he's human. I don't know, you'd have to ask him, but from what I understand, I mean, he's on some other type of realm of prolificacy, and the type of stuff he churns out of all genres. Like, he doesn't claim to think he's particularly a comedy writer, but the stuff he writes in our books, like, has me literally rolling on the floor laughing. So,
see, that's what I, you know, when you hit that, yeah, and you brought this up earlier too, and I wanted to touch on it. Like A Perfect Order, it has its funny parts to it. Like, there's sometimes in life, like, I put a premium on these people having like very human reactions, you know? So, because it's like going back to the fantasy we grew up with, right? The Arthurian legend, you get the magic sword, now I need to save the world. You know? It's like, well, I don't think most of us are really going to start wanting to go save the world if we find the magic sword. You know? Hell, most of us are probably going to see what we can cut through with it first. But yeah, if my life were like radically different, like let's say I was some single bachelor or something with no kids, I could probably get you like 200,000 words in a year. But like, I mean, that would be me at like full steam, you know? So to hear this guy's doing hundreds of thousands and then turning around and putting 12 more books out. Like,
yeah.
That's just insane to me.
Yeah.
I tip my hat like, holy crap.
Yeah. No. Yeah. He knows like, but I he's on a different level, and he's even like, he was with me interviewing Steven Erikson, and we were talking about it because, and we had that whole conversation about, you know, cause Steven Erikson also, writes books that are, 400,000 words long, and he's written like 10. I mean, it was over a longer period of time, but, basically reiterating what I said about, you know, people finding their own groove and doing what works for them and not allowing themselves to, be brought down by unreasonable expectations, because, you know, everybody's different. Like, I look at the way my wife and my daughter, will go to an amusement park and do every roller coaster in one day. I won't get on like the baby roller coaster. You know what I mean? Yeah, everybody's got their own things that they like and they can do and that they, you know what I mean? So it all, that's kind of the way it is. But I wanted to ask you, because we've been talking, I don't have a set time for this, but we've been talking a long time, and I want to make sure you have a chance to, you know, plug some of the stuff that's going on in the future. What do you have, what's coming out next? Like, what can people look forward to in the next, let's say, year?
Well, okay, so the next book in A Perfect Order, book 3, is called Maleficar, and the first two books, well, you know, and of course, they're the first one especially, is laying that foundation, you know. This is who this person is. Here's some new characters. Here's a foundation for what this world's kind of like. Book two is expanding on that more and kind of, hammering down on like how, like, for instance, the quote unquote magic, though it's actually never called magic, but my magic system, like how it works and what people are capable of doing and exploring more of that. Like, two, Almagest was kind of taking the training wheels off and not so much audience or reader hand-holding. Book three, though, is going to be like, we're completely taking the reins off. We're going to a different country. We're going to be going across multiple states, and I'm going to be pulling on my experiences of traveling and stuff to kind of give, kind of an authentic feel to it. Jennifer is someone who makes very rash decisions sometimes, and what she thinks is right. And sometimes it is, but we can't see all ends in life, and so she has some very real consequences coming up from the events of book two, especially, that kind of blows the lid off of this whole world and these secret, I'm using quotation fingers, secret societies. That's all going to be out for the world to see. And, so yeah, that's, with Almagest, like I said, I wrote that in, I established my own deadline of when I wanted it out. I wanted an October release. I wanted a Halloween release, but I had kind of got beat to the punch on that. And there were quite a few other authors, all wanting, with the company, with Kingston Publishing, that was wanting a Halloween. So I got handed October 13th. That's my wedding anniversary. So that worked real well. And I'm quite pleased with book two, but with three, I really want to take more time. And with, like I said earlier, I'd given myself 6 months with book two, Almagest. I ended up getting three. I would like to have this book coming up be like, really pace myself instead of writing feverishly. So that is the only thing I have on my agenda with, I'd like to get it out in the next 6 months. So like early summer. And,
nice.
And that's, well, I tell you one reason, why I was able to write so fast, with Almagest was my kids went to school. So I had a lot more time to myself to, write during the day. With this year coming up, it would be prime, writing time from now until, like June, for example. So that's, and it's just doing stuff like this, building the brand more and really seeking out, my audience, and getting more eyes on this thing as a whole.
Awesome. Well, I look forward to that. Obviously it's, sounds really exciting and, it seems like you've got the makings of a really cool series.
Well, let me add, we'll add something to this. And it's, this story is a little bit different from what most people have read. I'm not saying I'm a just complete old unique flower over here and I've had a completely original idea. I think, honestly, it's impossible to have original ideas practically when in creative fields, but we're all standing on, the shoulders of giants. And
yep. Every is a thief.
Yes, exactly. And, imitation is, the best form of flattery and all that good stuff. But it really is a little bit different from what most people have read. And that's a sentiment I get from readers. It's like, I haven't ever read anything quite like this before, but oh my gosh, and especially for female readers, the overwhelming, feedback I've been getting is that Jennifer is widely loved because she, like we've been saying this whole time, she's a human being. And yes, sometimes she tries to be noble and fails. Sometimes she succeeds. Sometimes she might make a rash decision because that seemed like that was the best thing to do at the time. But she's always trying to do the best based on the information she's got at that time. And I think that's what we're all just trying to do. So I would strongly recommend anyone who has read fantasy in the past or sci-fi, because there's sci-fi elements too, to give it a shot. And I take entertaining people very seriously, and I will promise that people will be entertained when they read this book. That's my promise as the author. You will be entertained.
Awesome. Yeah, no, that's super cool and all, and definitely important. It's an important thing to think about, especially if you're making it a job, as your job is to entertain your bread and butter, the people that are going to be allowing you to do this. So I wanted to ask you, I like to end all my interviews with the same question, pretty much in every format, because I think it's really important. And I've heard lots of different answers. If you could give one piece of advice to new and aspiring authors, what would it be?
That there's no such thing as writer's block. Writer's block is usually anxiety. And if you're feeling real anxious, that's usually, I mean, you can just ask, it can sometimes be as simple as, do you need to eat? When was the last time you ate something?
Right.
You know, but I used to tutor college students in creative writing. And the first thing I would always tell them is I can't edit or help you with anything that's still in your head. It has to be on paper. And so many people get jammed up with the rules of writing or syntax and grammar and things like that. And it's like, we can go back and edit anything later. I can't help you with what's in your mind. So, my first and big piece of advice would be the idea, the dialogue, you know, all that, you have to get it out of your brain and get it onto paper, onto screen, you know, paper with quotation fingers, but, you know, get it down to your medium and, don't worry about the rules so much. All that can be fixed and it's a craft. Like you can't improve if you're not hammering on your craft. It's a skill. So if you get all jammed up thinking about the what ifs and, oh, did I do this right and all that kind of stuff, you'll freeze up and you won't be getting anything down. So whenever you're writing or whenever you're thinking about writing, just go. Just start. Just do it. That would be my number one piece of advice right there.
Yeah, and then I always reiterate, too, because it's something I've had to do before. If there's a certain scene that you're struggling on that's not allowing you to go further in the writing because you're hung up on that one scene, maybe you can move on to another scene and maybe the inspiration you get from something that you know you want to happen later will then make what you're trying to work on earlier make so much more sense to you. Like there's not necessarily rules to writing. Like there's not, you know, like that whole, I hate to go into plotters and pantsers and stuff like that. It's just, to generalize further, there are no rules. And just because you can't get through one fight scene doesn't mean that you should move on to the next big character development or the next big introduction to a new POV or something like that.
Because the whole thing about motivation, you can't just sit and wait for motivation to strike. You have to help it sometimes, you know, like, well, all the time, really, because once you start that writing, you will feel that sense of reward because you've created something from nothing. And when you're going back reading over it, you're like, hey, I made this. So there's that good positive feedback, you know, those good chemicals from the brain, you know, that will reward you. But if you're just sitting around waiting on motivation to strike, it's probably not going to happen. You're just going to waste a day.
Exactly. Very, very true words. Drew, where can people find you on? Exactly. Where can people find you online if they want to find out more about you?
Oh, man. Well, I wish we could just flash my Linktree up there because that's the easiest way to find me is linktree.com/thatauthordrew /thatauthordrew. But I'm on Facebook as Drew Kintz. I'm the only Drew Kintz on Facebook. And on Instagram, that's going to be the once and future Drew. But my link tree, you know, it's linktree.com/thatauthordrew is going to have all the links to interviews, to buying the book, to reviews from like Literary Titan and Reader's Favorite. And this interview will be up there too once we're done and it's posted.
Awesome. And that shouldn't take too long. We work really fast. So Drew, it was amazing talking to you. This may be the longest Authors in Focus podcast that we've ever done.
Well, anyone who knows me knows that I can talk.
No. It's awesome. And we don't have a set length on this thing. You know, everybody's different. And sometimes I look at the time when I'm interviewing and I'm like, I feel like we're almost done and it's only been 15 minutes. What am I going to do here? Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you'll never have that problem for me, brother, I promise.
That's awesome. No, I'm looking forward to, I have another podcast that we do called Book and a Pint, and I'm looking forward to having you on that one too. It's a different format, but yeah, this was great. And, I wish you the best of luck and success with, both the current books that you have published and everything that you've got coming out in the future. And, hope to see this series fly for you, brother.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me, Michael. Appreciate you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
This has been Authors in Focus. You can find my satirical fantasy novels on Amazon. Need help finding readers? Connect with me on Facebook in the Fantasy Sci-Fi Focus group or at authorsinfocus@gmail.com. You can find more episodes of this podcast at fantasy-focus.com and where your favorite podcasts are hosted.